Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thanks for the invitation to speak with you this afternoon. I think this is a real honour to be able to speak to CEDA and to such a prestigious audience. Can I start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land, the Kaurna people, also the State Director of CEDA, Hamilton Calder, Byron Gregory, the Chief Executive Officer of Health Partners SA, and I understand a major sponsor today, so thank you for that, Byron, and of course to Professor Justin Bilby, the Executive Dean, Faculty of Health Sciences at the University of Adelaide. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Kevin Rudd, the Leader of the Opposition at a federal level, said last week that being a state health minister is one of the most difficult jobs in the world. Now, I thought about that, and I thought I could think of a number of jobs that are more difficult. Being a brain surgeon, I think, would be a level of difficulty a lot higher than being a state minister, but I have a feeling for what he means. It certainly is one of the most interesting jobs in the world. It's certainly one of the most interesting jobs in state politics, and this is probably one of the most interesting times to be a state health minister. So I'm really relishing the job that I have. I've now been doing it for 2 years, just talking to Jim there, and the thing we know about health ministers, if you do a bad job, they move you into something else, which is obviously a relief, and if you do a good job, you kind of get to stay there forever. So I'm at that relative period where I don't know whether I've done a good job or a bad job. I'll know in the next few years, I guess, which way it goes. I think one of the things I should say to start, and that's really in part a reflection on the analysis that Justin gave, which I completely agree with, is that we do have a good health system in South Australia. We have an excellent health system in Australia generally, and we shouldn't lose sight of that. It's a system that's been built on the backs of a whole range of policy initiatives, a whole lot of funding, a whole lot of personal commitments over many years, and we're very lucky to have the system we have in South Australia. But we do need to reform that system. We do need to make it a sustainable system, and I believe we can change it around to make it a truly great system so that our children and grandchildren can have the kind of health outcomes that we would hope for them. The reform agenda that we're embarking on in South Australia at the moment covers a number of areas. We're certainly trying to reform in the areas of policy, in the way we deliver services. We're reforming in relation to legislation. We've got an act before Parliament, or bill before Parliament at the moment, the healthcare bill, which is the first serious attempt to review our state health legislation since 1976. And, of course, the governance arrangements that we have in place in South Australia, and we're also wanting to reform the infrastructure that we have in our state. Justin mentioned some of the drivers for that reform. I'll just go through them briefly. Clearly, the demography of our state is one of the key drivers. Our population is, as Justin said, ageing. It's also growing at a faster rate than we would have anticipated. Under our state strategic plan, we said that we should have a population of 2 million by the year 2050. The current predictions are that we'll reach that by about 2030 or thereabouts. So we do have a growing population, but it is an ageing population. As Justin said, in 15 years' time, the number of people who are over 65 will double. We know that those in the age group 65 to 75 use hospital services about twice the rate of the average, and those over the age of 85, five times the rate of the average citizen. So we're going to have more 85-year-olds, more 95-year-olds, more centurions. We know that the demand for our services will continue to grow right through till about 2040, when the baby boomer generation exhausts itself. And those, and I'm a member of that generation, so I know my generation wants the very best in possible care, and we want to live for a very long, healthy life, and we will be demanding a lot of services. And so that demand is a very strong factor in the services that we need to create. The third issue, which Justin mentioned too, is the workforce. We know that about 40% of our clinical workforce, our medical workforce, will retire in the next 15 years, and they need to be replaced. I don't think it'll be too difficult to get people to line up to be doctors, but it will be difficult to get people to line up to be nurses and fill some of the other allied health roles that we have. Just for information, over the last 5 years in the State Health Service, we've employed an extra 2,406 nurses, 699 extra doctors. David, we should just try and find one extra one to round that number out. And 595 extra allied health workers. That's just over 5 years. And so to keep the service running at the same rate, we're going to have to find that number of people every 5 years from now on. Fortunately, there are more training places being made available through the university, so that will help to some degree. The next factor is really our infrastructure. We have the oldest infrastructure in our hospitals of all of the Australian states, or pretty close to it. A very large percentage of our infrastructure is over 35 years of age. Chronic disease was an issue that Justin raised. I'm told there are 450,000 South Australians over the age of 20 years who have at least one preventable chronic disease. One preventable chronic disease. So that's about a third of our population has an illness they shouldn't have. The obesity issue is obviously putting a lot of pressure on our system. Over half our adult population is overweight or obese, and the younger population is rapidly reaching that proportion as well. The increase in being overweight or obese amongst young people is growing around about the rate of 1% a year. And I think it's in the next 10 or 15 years, it's predicted half the children in our state will be in one of those two categories. Funding is obviously a key issue. As a state, we're putting in something like $3.4 billion a year into the health system. That's just under 30% of our state budget. I think it's 28, 29% thereabouts of our state budget is going into health. We know that in order to keep providing the services, we take into account the demand and also the costs, the inflation rate in health, which is much greater than it is in the normal community, the broader community, partly because of the supply and demand issues around doctors and nurses, we having to pay them more to attract them. Also, the technologies, the drugs and so on are expensive that come online. But if we take into account all those factors, the increase, just to stand still and keep pace with the growth and demand, is about 8 to 10% annually that we have to put in addition to what we currently put in. Our growth in our state revenue is about 4.5%. So if you look at those two factors, we've been able to work it out, and I've said it many times before, around about 2035, at the current rate of growth, the entire state budget will have to be spent on health in order to do what we do now for the population that we will have at that time. Now, clearly, that is not sustainable, and it's absurd, but that is the reality. One of the critical issues in all of this has been the contribution that the Commonwealth makes to the healthcare system. They obviously fund Medicare and the PBS scheme and a whole range of initiatives which are laudable, but they used to fund our public hospital system on a 50-50 basis. There was a fair arrangement in place. States had put in 50%, we put in 50%, they had put in 50%. We have what's known as an Australian Healthcare Agreement, which many of you would be familiar with, which is signed every 5 years. The last time it was signed, the Commonwealth and the state started off by putting in 50%, but the Commonwealth said, we will only inflate our contribution by 4.5%. The consequence of that has been that South Australia is about $1 billion over the course of that time worse off than we would have been if they'd inflated it at the true rate of health inflation, which is, as I say, somewhere between 8 and 10%. As a consequence of that, the state has had to put in a disproportionately large sum of money. And that is a very critical issue. And I want to talk a little bit more about the Commonwealth's role in health later, but that factor is one of the major drivers of change. So I guess we could say there's a positive outcome from that because it's causing us to make changes at a faster rate than maybe we otherwise would have had to do it. Just to say a little bit about our hospital system, because at the moment there's all sorts of commentary about how the hospital's working. There are national reports which compare the hospitals from one state to another. And in our state, 82% of people in need of elective surgery receive that surgery in the recommended time frame. So that's 82%. 96% of the patients in South Australia who are looking for elective surgery receive that surgery within 12 months. Only 4% wait longer than 12 months. And we're the second best in Australia at that. We're the third best in relation to the total number who are done in the appropriate time frame. And in terms of beds, we've got more beds per head of population than I think any other state. There might be one of the territories has a slightly better ratio. It's because one of our issues is that we have more beds per head of population, so we have a greater focus on acute care rather than primary care. Our emergency departments treat something like 94,000 people a year, and there's been a 5.37% growth in the attendances in emergency departments in the last 12 months. And that figure, anybody from the hospitals could correct me, but I think that figure has been around for some time. We're growing our emergency departments about 5% a year. That's driven by our ageing population. It's also driven by the lack of access to GPs in certain areas, particularly after hours on weekends, and by the fact that some people can't get access to bulk billing GPs, so they prefer to go to an emergency department. When we first came to government a few years ago, 5 years ago now, we had a review of our health system, a generational health review run by John Menadue, and he kind of, and Justin went through some of his figures, but if you can boil down what he said, he really said two things. We have to have a system which is much more strongly focused on prevention and primary health care, and we have to reorganise our acute services so we're using them in a more efficient, rational, sensible way. And so that all of those things, those factors in the GHR have really led to the model of care that we're proposing through our healthcare plan. We're not proposing, that we're rolling out through our healthcare plan. We announced that just before the budget this year, and you would be roughly familiar with it, but the aim of this plan is for us, and just talking about the city for a moment, I'll talk about the country later, but in the city we don't want to have every one of our 8 hospitals trying to provide every service to every individual within walking distance of that facility. We want to have a more sensible approach to the delivery of healthcare so that there are only 3 hospitals which are dealing with the most complex issues, one in the north of our city, one in the south of our city, and one in the centre, with the other hospitals specialising in services which are appropriate to their local communities, particularly services to do with ageing, so rehabilitation, palliative care, assessment for other services, ambulatory care and so on, and of course more elective surgery. So that's kind of the model that we've put out there. And there is pain associated with that for some people, because what we're saying is that ambition you had for your hospital to grow in that particular direction, you'll have to revisit. That service that you have there is now going to be provided through this institution. You will be familiar with some of the arguments, and there's been plenty of talk about it in the media, and I won't go through the details unless somebody wants to ask me particular questions. But our goal is to have fewer high-level acute services, but those services that which we do run will be run at the in the best possible way that we can manage it as a community, and have our other services providing the other kinds of other hospitals providing the other kind of services that we require. Now, to do that, we're investing large sums of money. The budget that we announced put in $2.2 billion worth of extra capital into our health system. $1.7 billion, it's a large lump of that, will be provided to build the Marjorie Jackson Nelson Hospital on the railway land at the western end of the North Terrace. We made that decision. We were looking at rebuilding the RAH and what that would cost. That would have cost about $1.3 billion. It would have taken 5-6 years longer to construct. It would have meant that hospital would have been a building site for something like 10 or 12 years, so effectively 10% of the hospital would have been closed for services for every single one of those years. And at the end of the time, we would still have the RAH looking like it does, a rabbit warren of buildings, unconnected, unplanned, modern, but not ideal. The alternative is to build on the new site, state-of-the-art, world-class hospital, thought through with clinicians involved very much in the planning, to build for the future, so it's future-proofing the hospital and maximising the benefits of that thinking in the design. And we also believe, as a result of that design, we will save a lot of money in the running of the hospital. Staff will have to walk less distance to get from one place to another. We can build in much more efficient energy use and a whole range of other things. So we think within the first few years of that hospital being in operation, the difference in the cost of the 1.7 billion and the 1.3 billion for the RAH renewal will be saved, and there will be ongoing savings after that. I want to talk a little bit about that hospital in relation to other things, and Justin made the point, and I think this is an incredibly important point, the significance of which I hope is not lost on this audience, but he made the point that the three universities will cooperate to provide training on that site. That is a unique outcome. I don't know any other state in Australia which would have that, and there's probably not too many services in this state where the three universities are working together. Not to say they'll be delivering the same training, but they will work together on the one site, so we don't have to have three new training institutions there. So I think that's fantastic. If we manage to get that happening, that's a great outcome apart from anything else. We're also spending $202 million upgrading the Lyell McEwen Hospital. Now, I mention that in particular because part of the argument against those who argue against what we're doing is saying, well, we should leave the existing infrastructure in place. But the reality is the northern part of our state, the northern part of our city, and that's a large part of the social demographic group that Justin was referring to, who aren't getting access to services, don't have access to the most advanced and the highest level acute services that people who live in the close to the city have. There has been no major acute hospital in the northern suburbs. We will build one there, and that will be the Lyell McEwen Hospital. That's had some consequential effects, of course, on Modbury and QEH, but it is absolutely important for that community to have close access to a high-level tertiary hospital. Flinders Medical Centre, we're spending $150+ million there doing some work on that. 31 has been committed for the Nalunga Hospital, 12 for Modbury, 120 on QEH, which is an ongoing program. So all of that is capital infrastructure in the city. We're spending some money in the country as well. And we're also committing $215 million over that period of time to invest in technology. Information management in health is just a nightmare. And one of the first briefings I had from the chief information officer of the department, and I can't remember exactly the number, but there were hundreds and hundreds of information systems, software systems that we have in health, various bits of it. And I guess it's easy to understand because when that sort of information technology was coming to the fore 15, 20 years ago, there were no systems in place at a government level. It was a group of individuals in a particular hospital said, this will be a good thing for us to use, and then all of those good things have developed their own character and they don't really communicate with each other very well. There's a lot more that we can do in technology to make our system work better. Recently I had a visit to Denmark with Tony Sherbon, the head of the department, to look at the information systems they have there, and it would make you weep. Tony said to me at the end, we're about 20 years away from that technology. They have there is a website which has all the information about all the hospitals and all of the services that are provided in the health system in that country. There is a unique identifier for every individual citizen. They, of their own, on their own accord, can register on that site, and all of the information that is associated with their healthcare over their history is provided on a screen. So all the medication are on, all the doctors they've seen, all the treatments they've had, all of everything that you'd ever require, and just by using, I guess, the equivalent of an identity number, they can have a look at it. They can see who has also accessed that information, so they can know if people have been looking and who shouldn't have been. And in an emergency, of course, the emergency departments can automatically access it and find out what the complications, what the problems, what the issues are. And it's such a fantastically simple system. Every part of the health service in Denmark is connected into it. Now, we're about 20 years away from that, I gather. So, but that's where we need to go, and we are investing considerable sums of money in doing that. So that's what we're doing with the acute system, recreating our acute system so that we have a spine of acute service providers, the tertiary service providers, with general hospital work being provided by the other hospitals. And we want to run that as a system, not as eight separate hospitals, each looking into their own walls for their own culture and own goals. We want to have a system-wide approach. In addition to that, we're investing reasonably heavily in primary health care. The GP Plus healthcare notion is what we're using, that's the language we're using to describe this. But there's three parts to that. The first part is the creation of GP plus healthcare centres. We want to have one of those for about every 100,000 of our state's population, or particularly the metropolitan population. A little bit difficult in the country where the population spread more thinly, but about one for every 100,000 of our city. That'll be about 10 or so of these. There's a couple in existence already. Each one will be different depending on the demography and the available resources through other sources in that community. But essentially, they'll be about the provision of primary health prevention and all of those positive things at a population basis in a particular community. Ideally, they'll have a mixture of nurses, access to doctors. Some of the doctors will be working from them. Other doctors may come and do specialty clinics in particular things like diabetes management and so on. They may have dental chairs. They may have pharmacy. They may have day operations. They'll have lifestyle coaches. They'll have dietitians, nutritionists, a whole range of services. And the focus will be of that centre and the people working that centre working in close collaboration with the other providers of primary health, particularly doctors, GPs, working in closely with them to manage the population. We need to get this state, I think, where we understand each of those centres understands the community that it's serving and actively goes out to find people who need support, not wait for them to walk through the door. So working out who's at risk of getting diabetes, who's at risk of being obese, and so on. So that's the model that we're pinning a lot of our hopes on. We're also building that in the country as well. We know from the Aldinga GP Plus, which has been open just under a year now, that there's also already been an impact on the presentations at the local hospital and the Nalunga Hospital from people who are serviced by that community. We're just trying to get a more accurate sort of understanding about how that's working. In addition to that, we've got what we're calling GP plus nurses or practice nurses who we're funding as a state. This is a unique experience, I think, to this state. We're funding 50 nurses to work with general practitioners. We're providing them, we're paying for them to work for, I think, 4 or 5 months with a doctor's surgery with a team of doctors or an individual doctor to help take the pressure off the doctor, but also particularly start focusing on chronic disease management, on population health, getting out there and getting the message across and dealing with people so we can stop them getting ill. And after 4 or 5 months, the doctor or the surgery has the option of taking that person onto their staff, because they can get Medicare funding for them through a number of items. So far, I think 66% or thereabouts of these practice nurses have been taken on to the staffs of the various surgeries, which says a lot, I think, because it demonstrates that they actually can be self-funding, so they are profit centre for the doctor, but they're also providing a service which doctors really don't have the time to provide. And we're focusing these in the areas where there are fewer GPs, so the outer south, the outer north, and so on. This is a scheme, because only 50 of them, but we can keep rolling the salaries over and over and over and just getting out into that community. And I think it will have a very big impact on particularly our relations with GPs as a health department, as a health system, but also changing the practice of GPs, and I think that's a really important part of the process. The other thing, of course, we have established very good networks in each of the divisions, so all of the people who are involved in providing primary health care come together and work and plan and think through the things. Justin raised... Oh, the other thing I went to mention here is we're funding a lot more out-of-hospital care, so funding nurses and other allied health workers to go out into homes to keep people who have got a whole range of chronic diseases, particularly the elderly, who we know go to hospitals frequently, keep them as well as they can and managed in their homes so that they don't have to go to hospitals. And also some provision so that people who are currently going into hospitals but probably don't need to can be looked after at home. And when the Premier and I launched this, we attended a house with a nurse where there was a guy who had to go to hospital to have some antibiotics pumped into him through an IV, and he normally would have been in hospital for something like 10 days to have two shots a day provided by a nurse. He was having that at home. The cost of providing that at home to fund the nurse and the transport and everything was about $1,000 over that week or so. And in a hospital, it would have cost, I don't know, $7,000, $8,000, thereabouts. So clearly, it makes sense to invest in that. It's got to be better for the patient to be at home with his or her family. But attracting and retaining doctors and nurses is very important. We're about to go through a salary process with doctors at the moment, the salaried doctors, and we're looking for some, we hope for some structural changes there which will make it, the system work better for both the profession and for the and for those of us who are involved in the management of it. We've established, as Justin said, a whole series of clinical networks to keep get doctors engaged in thinking through things. One of the first things that I was told when I became minister from the doctors was how alienated they felt from the decision-making process of the hospitals, and there was an interesting article on Crikey yesterday by one of our leading surgeons about just that issue. They feel like they're not listened to, often petty things like they can't get a cup of coffee or a sandwich, or you know, there's nowhere to write down their notes. All those kind of things create frustrations. So we're trying to establish a stronger way of involving clinicians through these processes called clinical networks, so they can plan the service for the whole state through that mechanism and then have it implemented by this coordinated, integrated healthcare system we're trying to establish. The final point in terms of attraction and retention I wanted to talk about was research. I think it's absolutely vital that we make our whole system a research-focused system. Lots of research happening now in pockets all over the state, but we have the capacity, I think, to do a much bigger job, a much greater job than that. And I'm pleased that Alan Young is here. He and John Shine have been reviewing our research systems in South Australia and will make recommendations to me in the next month or so about how we should refocus research in South Australia. I think we've got the capacity to do a lot more research, to make all of our institutions research-focused, and I know that that's not only good for our economy because it brings money into our state, but it also makes our system a system that the very best medical people want to come to and will work in. Finally, if I can just talk briefly about legislation and governance. I have legislation before the Parliament at the moment to change the governance arrangements in South Australia. Historically, every hospital in South Australia has been managed by its own board, and so that makes the announcement by the federal government that they want to recreate a board for every hospital in Australia seem sort of a slight sense of deja vu, because I'm off in this direction to get rid of every single one of our boards, because the experience I think we've had in our state is not a very functional way of running our hospital system. In fact, John Menadue in his report said, the existing legislation of individual health unit boards has stood as a clear barrier to health system reform. And I think he was absolutely right. We want to have an integrated healthcare system which can be planned on a system basis, a population basis, not on an institution basis. We have to focus our attention on our population, on the people of our state, not on the institutions and the needs of institutions. Having boards really does focus the board on that institution. That's what boards are there for. They would be failing in their duties if they didn't do that. But we know, particularly in some of the country parts of our state, where the boards of volunteers come together perhaps once a month, a whole range of issues have occurred which have not been best practice. We want to have a strongly focused system with proper steps of supervision and accountability leading to me as the minister, so that we can guarantee that we have a very well-planned system. But under the individual board process, who makes the decision if a service is too expensive and it should be moved from one place to another? Well, individual boards won't be making that service. What they may decide is that that service is too expensive and they just close it down altogether. We're facing at the moment one of the private health providers has decided to get out of the provision of dialysis because it's not profitable for them, and that means there'll be a whole group of dialysis patients who will have nowhere to go. So the public health system will have to take them on. Under the model of care that the federal government's proposing, where would those patients go? And, in fact, would some of those individual hospitals who were running their own private shows decide that dialysis is too expensive an option, we don't really need to do that, those patients can go somewhere else? If that were to happen, who would step in? Under the model that's being proposed, there is no role for a state government. Who would the opposition ask questions of if there was no state minister responsible for these boards and no federal minister responsible? They would be complete unto themselves. And I think that you can easily see if you start exploring that idea, a whole range of problems might occur. There'd be some that would be working very well. And in fact, I suggest to you in the wealthier areas of the state that Justin talked about, those boards would run very well. They'd be able to accumulate funds, they'd be able to select the patients who had the best outcomes and so on. And then a whole lot of other areas would have run-down hospitals because they couldn't attract the best people to be on the boards, they couldn't attract the best doctors, they wouldn't have their best capital acquisition program and a whole range of other things like that. This is a crazy way to plan a healthcare system. What we're moving to in our state is to have an integrated healthcare system where there's proper levels of accountability and proper involvement of the community, but not in the decisions about what's appropriate in terms of clinical services or how to run individual budgets. One of the things that I do want to create through this legislation is a Health Performance Council, which will be an arm's length body separate from the department, which will report to me and to the Parliament every year on the performance of our system, so that there's an honest appraisal of where we're going, where the errors are, where the areas of improvement should be, and also report on the state of health in our state every 4 years, so that the Parliament and the public will know how well we're going in terms of managing obesity, managing smoking reduction, managing all the things we think are important in our state. One other final thing I wanted to say. All of these things are happening at once. We've got a lot of reform happening. It's a bit like trying to do a Rubik's Cube, but I noticed the world record for doing Rubik's Cube is about 9.4 seconds. I saw in the paper the other day, so maybe it's not that hard after all. But one final thing I want to do, and I want to say it particularly to this audience because many of you come from outside the public health sector. I am very committed as a government and a public health representative of public health to work very closely with the private health sector. And in fact, I've asked the department to work on a paper which I want to present at some stage in the near future to establish some sort of charter or compact which all of the private sector providers for health care, so the aged homes, the pharmacists, the private insurance companies, private hospitals, universities, anybody, non-government sector, anybody who's involved in healthcare could be involved in. So we could come together and agree on some broad principles that we're aiming for in health in our state, and then we set up some mechanisms where we can work together. And I'll just give you one simple example. If we decided obesity was a problem and we wanted to run a campaign around obesity, that would be something we could work on together, and through each of the enterprises or institutions we're involved in, we could be sending out messages which were consistent one with the other at the same time. I think that would have a lot more impact in our community than if every individual group from time to time decided to have particular messages going out. So I'll leave you at that as my final point. I'm very keen to have us work together in that collaborative way. The pressures on our health system are so great that none of us, it seems to me, especially the state government, can afford to be isolated and defensive about our territory. We really need to embrace all sectors in dealing with this very big issue. Thank you very much.